personal at all. So we raised a couple of kids, and someone just talked about my younger boy last year, Randy Iditarod, and ended up now being on the chat line. And that's an act of Congress getting him to put more than two words together. So you guys can do more than the parents can do. But I think fun is my middle name, so I need to have a good time no matter what I do. And in gatherings like that, we hopefully can be as informal as we need to be, and it's always a lot of fun. I'm on Alaska time, so I probably will stay awake longer than any of you guys, and unfortunately some of you have to work for a living. It's a really bad habit to have. It gets into the time with the dogs very much, you know, so, but it does of course help pay the bill. So I appreciate the students that have studied the Iditarod in school, and that's always a highlight when we can share some more in-depth information. Often I'm surprised how much people know about my dogs or myself, and that of course is in part because my wife Kathy keeps a pretty detailed website up and running, and especially now that she, after I think 25 years of classroom teaching, she became my full-time manager, part-time teacher, and she has all kinds of other side jobs, but I very much appreciate her involvement in the kennel, and have for over 25 years, of course. At first, mostly behind the scenes, but now more in a manage Martin mode, because my schedule has been getting a little crazy the last few years, and it's nice to have somebody arrange the travel and make the plans, and unfortunately learn to say no. You know, there's only so many schools and only so many things you can do, and you have to pick a paying appearance and balance it out with a pro bono appearance. And I'll just tell you a quick story about one of my appearances in a school that struck me as pretty funny. The principal called me up. The town is Shaktulik, which is a little Eskimo town on the Iditarod Trail, and I was invited to become the commencement speaker, and of course you don't turn that down. You can't say, no, I'm not coming. At the same breath, the principal says, but we have to let you know that you're not our first choice. which is sort of an interesting statement, you know, and within the same breath he says, but Michael Jordan was busy. So I felt elevated. That was a pretty big honor. If you know anything about Alaska sports, there's two sports. One is indoor, and that's basketball. Even the short Indian and Eskimo kids love to play basketball, because most villages, even if it's only 60 or 80 people in the town, they have a big gymnasium. So hoops is huge. So I was invited to go to Shaktulik and give a commencement speech, and of course it's a two-day trip. You fly to Unalakleet with the regular size prop plane, and then you hop into a mail hopper, you know, and then finally you're there, and then the reverse is the same. Graduating class was pretty exciting. He was about 18 years old, and he was and in order to make a ceremony out of it, of course we're having 200 people, which is every soul in Shaktulik, in the gymnasium. So they graduate the kindergartner into the first grade and make a big deal about it, and then the third grader goes into fourth grade, and so we make a huge celebration out of it. And I gave a little commencement speech and tried to make it pertinent to the student that is now moving on to another important part of his life. And so I do a lot of little things like that, and I feel privileged and a great honor when I'm invited to do those sort of things. And this gathering kind of happened along the way. I was asked to maybe give a few insights to what I do. And I'm one of the happiest guys in the world, because I get to truly do what I love doing. You know, if you find your passion, and that goes not only to young people, but if you find your passion and you can make a living at it or scrape a living together, you never feel like you're going to work. My days kind of consist of the first 8 hours I work at my hobby, which is my dogs. And the second 8 hours of the day I work at my job, which is training dogs and scooping and cleaning and all that. So I get a good 16-hour day in every day. Yet often I never leave my home or my surroundings. The good days, like I say, are the days I go out the back way. And I can go from my house to Nome without crossing the road. so you will see some pictures on how diverse the trip to Nome can be, and is, and of course I don't know much about it. I've only done it 26 times so far, but gathered some insights along the way. And but I know a lot of you are dog owners, and if we just answer a few questions the first 10, 15 minutes, then maybe I can draw some analysis when I talk about the Iditarod. So if any of you have a question, we can maybe start with that.
How many calories a day does your dog burn on the trail?
On the trail, we, and you've heard that I contribute to some of the research. I feel it's important. I'm one of the guys that believes that sharing knowledge will give you knowledge back. There's different philosophies about knowledge, and mine is I gain more the more I share. So I contribute and help with just about any research program that I'm asked to do. The research that was done on the Copper Basin on a really, really cold race, 45 to 50 below, was a nutritional study done with traceable isotopes. The dogs were basically given water that could be measured later on. The output was measured and mathematically could be determined how much the dogs were actually burning by input, output, and body weight and all that. And in that race, it was determined that the dogs metabolize up to 11,000 calories in a 24-hour period. Now that's an awful much. That none of us, I know you tried for dinner. but none of us in this room could possibly metabolize 11,000 calories in a 24-hour period. The only way, of course, you do that is by lots of meals, lots of energy output spread out over a 24-hour period. That is probably the what I call the caninely upper limit. That's probably the maximum that a dog can metabolize. It's not that high on an Iditarod day simply because the intensity and usually the temperature is not that bad. So the 300-mile races that we do sometimes are very, very intense. I think I still have the world record for the fastest 300 miles, 34 hours and 12 minutes, including 12 hours of layover. If you do the math, you're coming up with about 14 to 16 miles an hour. That was a Cusco race done in 1994, and that record still stands. 300 miles of tailwind. And it's those of you that know the race, it's 150 out and 150 back. I went to Antioch, waited a few hours, the wind shifted 180 degrees and blew me back to the finish line. That time has not been equaled since. So that's the metabolic output that the dog can do. Humanoids are maybe half that. We contributed to some of those studies on a warm Iditarod when we did basically the same. Peed in a cup at sunrise and saved our data that way. And we started at 4 to 4,500 calories a day and ended up probably at 60 to 6,500 calories towards the end when your body is fatigued and the intensity is increased, you're sleeping yet a little less. But that was done in a warm race. So I know humanoids are probably higher on cold races like it was this year. But that's sort of the range between 4 to probably 7 or 8,000 calories on a person and between 8 and 11,000 on a canine. And we're talking, our dogs are typically about 54, 55 pound. I do statistics on my dogs. I have too much data in my head. but typically I do a team average. I weigh all my dogs and then we take a team average, and they will typically have about 2,500 to 3,500 miles, depending on the year, of training in harness. We only measure harness miles. And this year the team average was like 4.5 years old, because I had a 2.5 year old and I had 6.5 year old. So my team is pretty prime right now. And I think I had the 54.5 pound team average for weight. So we keep track of little things like that.
How long after dinner do they run?
How long after dinner do they run? Iditarod is different, of course. Iditarod, we feed and run. In order to get 6 to 8 meals into a dog, you got to feed them all the time. And the reason we get away with that, of course, is we feed super diets and we feed small quantities. Our dogs, my dogs I often call hummingbirds. My dogs can pretty much free feed, they don't overeat. In the last 26 Iditarods, I think I only had two dogs that would actually overeat, that I would have physically to make sure I didn't let them eat anymore. The rest of my dogs, because they're burning so much, it's awfully hard to put 11,000 calories into a dog. So a typical routine, and somebody mentioned the 8 days, 22 hours and some stuff, that's 200 hours on the trail. Out of those 200 hours, only two entities, myself and my dogs, know how much I rested. That's now changing since we're carrying those tracking devices. But out of that, in the O2 record run, my dogs rested 51% and ran 49% of the time. Basically 100 hours resting and 100 hours of traveling. Every time I stop, I feed the dogs, and every time I get ready to go, I feed them again. Often I have a meal in between. There's some timing issues. Your dogs will absorb moisture, water, to the optimum about two hours after the primary meal. So often I wait for, I arrive in the checkpoint, I feed the dogs their primary meal, which sometimes consists of straight commercial dog food in one bowl and eagle and water in the other bowl. And then 2 hours later, I will have a soup made. I might have made a pot of hot water, poured over fresh cut salmon, and now that's a salmon-y, smelly, really good, by now it's cool or lukewarm broth, and that seems to be absorbed the best about two hours after the initial meal. So that's the second meal on a typical checkpoint stop, and then the third meal would be immediately before I go. That might consist of a snack or a regular meal, or just smaller quantities, depending on what my pattern is, where how far I'm going, and what I'm doing in the next 6 to 8 hours. Yes, ma'am.
You don't have a problem with regurgitation or bloat?
No bloat, no.
Is that just because your breed isn't...
Typically, bloat, I think, speaking from a little bit of experience, bloat usually only happens if you feed large quantities a few times a day. Any dog that has a tendency to bloat, if you deliver their nutritional intake divided preferably over three feedings a day, they will never bloat again. It's a quantity
yeah.
Deal, and we don't run into that problem because we keep
barrel tested dogs seem to be more susceptible to.
Yeah, our dogs are pretty narrow. We need to accommodate those legs to run. We can't have barrel chests. So yeah, it's definitely breed specific. In all my years, I lost one pup to bloat. Or a twisted stomach. That might have been a different reason too, but he certainly had food in it. Yes.
I have more of a humanoid question. This is my first experience with Iditarod and looking up information. And there's a lot of rookies that participate. Do you pros who've done it for really long time? Is there any kind of mentoring program or?
There's actually fewer and fewer rookies, because Iditarod is making it almost impossible. If you're deciding to run Iditarod next year, you couldn't do it. You would have to qualify. Now it's a minimum of a two-year program. You would have to qualify by running a 200 and a 300 mile race before you're even allowed, quote unquote, to sign up for the Iditarod. And then you're required to plop down $5,000 as an entry fee, which is ridiculous. We're eliminating the wrong kind of people by making it elitist. Mm-hmm. Lance Mackey, a few years ago, he couldn't have come up with $5,000. And he did pretty good. But Joe Blow, the stockbroker from New York, that wants to run the Iditarod because the Iditarod is the toughest and longest run. He's not a dog musher, he's a stockbroker. He should be doing what he does well. He can come up with $5,000 and could become a potential problem. So there's a rookie meeting, 2 days of mandatory meetings. One day is usually in Anchorage and the other day is at my kennel. All rookies are required to attend that. In that day, I bombard the rookies with as much information as you can possibly absorb, and I will give you handout after handout, and I feel in part responsible for what happened this year on the Iditarod Trail, and I pledge to do a more in-depth, and if they can't make it mandatory, make it a voluntary rookie meeting that lasts more than one day at my kennel, where I need to... A bunch of mistakes were made this year on the Iditarod that from a professional point of view are so asinine that if you have 8 foot of snow, you don't leave your dogs exposed to the howling winds at 40 below. You dig down in the soft snow. And being a professional dog racer, I don't even think about sharing that with you, because there is so many things we do instinctively that the dog care is one of them. That we just, and you know how assume is spelled, you know, I assume that certain skills are required. So now we have to go back a little bit and go to the, like what we do with our society, we dumb it down to the lowest common denominator, and now we need to discern where that lowest common denominator is. And it's my responsibility in part, being a mentor, to teach rookies, new beginning racers, to have more tools in their chest to better take care of their dogs. So it's definitely a 2-year process, and from now on you'll be even more educated by the time you hit the Iditarod Trail.
Is there any kind of program in place where the stockbroker from New York could finance somebody whose dream it is to run the Iditarod but can't come up with that kind of money?
Absolutely. There's all kinds of different programs. There is, there is scholarships. There is the Leonard Cepola scholarship is of somebody on off the road system. You know, usually it's targeted to somebody that lives in the bush, which is very difficult to come up with the finances, in part because of geographic difficulties. So yeah, there is all kinds of different mentorship.
So somebody that can't come up with the money could seek out sponsorship.
Absolutely, we all do. That's how I make most of my living. Is I work with sponsors that see some sort of merit. I don't know why of working with me. And if you're astute about it, you give back as much as you receive. Otherwise, it's a one-way deal, and it probably won't last very long. But I tried to give back, and I'm fortunate to have had several of my sponsors for over 20 years now. Two people, the Eagle Dog Food Company and my transportation sponsor in Nome, they were in the Elite Before Championship Club, which you could never join now, because if somebody sponsors you before you win, that's a great honor, that's a big deal. And we give them, of course, preferential treatment, because they have believed in me and they helped me grow. But to this day, they don't come to me. To this day, I still got to beat the bushes. I still got to negotiate deals and look for, I call it tuition nowadays. Two kids in college, so join the club. Yes?
Being a dog owner, we always talk about having our once in a lifetime dog. There's just that one. Who is it for you and why?
I really try not to. I train my head to be happiest with the dog I'm interacting at the moment, to be most content in the place that I'm at, and you right now are my most favorite person in the world. That's sort of a mindset. Of course, knowing about 500 dogs by name and about 10 people, I've had very, very many special dogs. I got so many dog stories I'm writing a book. I could write many books. Right now I hate writing books. It just takes a lot of time. It's just, don't count on it.
We'll talk. I'm going to help you.
I've been pestered so much. And I got lots of stories together. But, you know, over the years, you have special dogs, and they end up being super lead dogs or dogs that connect with you. You know, I can tell stories of steering dogs without saying a word. I'm thinking you're going right, and you're going right. You know, and I'm thinking you're going left, and you're going left. You know, that's that connection with special dogs is pretty incredible. The you know, a dog that has taught me a lot is Eleanor. the storm of 91 is a pretty big story and would be a big chapter in the book, is a big chapter in the book. 91 is probably the biggest storm anybody has traveled through in recent history. It's quite a while ago now. Five of us left the second last checkpoint, White Mountain, 77 miles from the finish line, and the local people said, don't go, it's not doable. But it was about like this, calm and nice and no big deal, you know. Maybe a few big snowflakes were coming straight, fluttering just straight down, no big deal. Well, I was fifth. Susan Butcher was first. She had won the race. She had forgotten about the last 77 miles, but in her mind she had won the race, and she kind of made her victory speech in White Mountain, and then left. Rick Svensson left, Joe Runyon left, Timmy Osmore left, and I was fifth in row. And after a couple hours on the trail, it got pretty windy, and you could still see. I could see as far as the end of this room, probably, and I started having a head on with a dog team, and it was my girlfriend coming this way. Susan Butcher for years was my girlfriend, because being a happily married man, I'm not allowed to chase women. And by then she had still finished in front of me, so she was the only girl I was allowed to chase. And for a long time we told stories on each other, of course. We became good friends, but also strong competitors. So she came head on, and I was still going in the right direction, and she says, well, it's not doable. Rick Svensson is freezing up there. He's losing his hands. He can't find his headlight. It can't be done. But knowing you, you're probably going to find out for yourself. I said, damn right. And on we went. And then Joe Runyon a few minutes later came, and we had a head-on with Joe, and he says, it can't be done, I can't do it, I'm going back to White Mountain. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to keep on trying. And I started having little butterflies, you know. I'm still that arrogant kid from Switzerland that don't know much, you know. I only had, what, six or seven Iditarods under my belt. That was my eighth. Then I have a head-on with Timmy Osmore, who I had worked with in the summertime, and he's a pretty hard-working dude and pretty tough. I had high regards of him. He finished fourth in the Iditarod 4 years in a row, and not very many tougher people than he. And he just shook his head. He doesn't say much. He's kind of like growing, and, you know, just shook his head and kept on going. Well, but I also learned some basic math. 5 take away 3. Now I'm in second place on the Iditarod Trail, and I got 70 miles to go, maybe now 60. And my friend Rick Svensson is somewhere supposedly losing his hands and not knowing where he's going. So my goal was to go forward, plus I had enough food and I had trust in my dogs. And then it got pretty bad. Then it got bad enough to where I was the lead dog, and that's where Eleanor couldn't comprehend 40 knot winds at a 45 degree angle going over hill and dale. We're on the coast, we're going up and over mountains, and you don't follow a straight line. You can't take a compass heading, you got to find the trail. And it was just too difficult for her. So I put on a line on my waist, and Eleanor and I walked for 27 hours side by side. That does something to you. You know, it's the unspoken bond that you develop with a dog and a dog team in a situation like that is I've never been in combat, but it's very much like being in combat. And only people that have gone through something like that can really understand. And if you have mastered situations with special dogs like that, you never forget them, you know. Then the next year, and I in that storm, and I openly tell people I came in second. I mean, we did for 27 hours. Svensson could have been a mile ahead of me, he could have been an hour ahead of me. For that whole day and then so, we mimicked each other's moves. We were shut down for about 4 hours because it was so bad. We got going again, and he pulled into safety 20 miles from the finish line, and he told the media, don't say a word. And I pulled in, I snuck into safety with my headlight off, because it started getting 20 miles from the finish, it started getting a little better visibility, and I snuck into safety. As I'm riding into safety, I hear on my radio, now we're in radio reception from Nome, I hear that Svensson had come and gone an hour later. And I had just about opened the door to the checkpoint to sign in, and I was going to leave the same exact instruction, knowing full well that Rick probably was listening to the radio as well. So we mimicked each other's moves for a whole day in the storm, and it was pretty hard, pretty challenging, and typical minor frostbite, you know, fingers and toes and face and stuff. But I learned to win in that race. I learned to trust myself, trust my dogs, gain the confidence, and then the year after that, I won in 92. I won my first Iditarod in record-setting time. So the dogs that help you do that, they become pretty special. And we were very, very proud of those dogs because they were, for the vast majority, already our own dogs. Dogs that I had raised out of some of our, what we call our foundation dogs. Dogs that were born and raised at Happy Trails Kennel. And that might be a good segue. Do we need to lower the lights a little bit, or can you see reasonably well? Okay. So what I want to do is I want to show you, and if you need to relocate, feel free to move around so you can see the screen better, because I'll do this from here. All the pictures are taken by professional photographers. Most of them by Jeff Schultz, some of them by his staff. He is the professional photographer that does... made his mark with the Iditarod. He's now, of course, a successful businessman in Alaska, and he does other things as well, but for, I think this was his 23rd or 24th Iditarod, that he has almost as many as I have, that he has followed by any means of transportation. So the pictures you see are truly professional pictures that are taken. A lot of them from the air, a lot of them from the flies literally for hours just to set up the tripod and the camera to take special pictures. So he's pretty determined picture taker. And the photos you will see are all pretty much taken by him. And they span from the 1992, I just can't get rid of the 92 dogs. They span from 1992 until just very recently. I don't think I've incorporated any of this year's race. That was not worth incorporating anyway. But in 1992, we were still allowed to raise 20 dogs. And that was quite a thrill. And this 200-pounder, of course, prefers to run 20 dogs versus those little puny 90-pounders, you know, when Didi John Rowe hooks up 16 dogs, they don't even know. Kind of had a pound per dog ratio, but they don't want to go for that. So that's Eleanor and D2, ultimately two dogs that became pretty famous. D2 is on our right, and Eleanor is the darker dog. Those are two of the great dogs. And Eleanor, of course, was named after Eleanor Roosevelt. And D2 is named after his father, who is actually in the third position, two behind him, a dog named Dagger. That was his father. That team was comprised of 8 littermates, their parents, Angel and Dagger, and about 4 half-brothers. Some pretty darn good breeding. And that might lead to a good little saying that people used to say, well, my first litter was the best. And my answer to that is, if you treat every litter like it's your first litter, they're all just as good. You tend to get too busy with your second or third litter that you don't invest the time that you do with your first litter. If you make a point of that, then all your litters are probably the same. Don't be too busy. Don't have too many dogs to be really in your young dogs' heads. So. And if you see anything in any picture, feel free to just, you know, speak up, because I've seen them before.
Is Eleanor still alive?
Mm-mm. No, Eleanor would. No, she's long gone. Anytime you see a driver with a bib on, he's really close to the start or really close to the finish. We don't wear those darn bibs other than at the beginning, at the end. They're mandatory at the start and at the finish, but they're certainly... We give them up. The ceremonial start is still a ceremonial deal on Saturday, and then on Sunday we only wear it for the first 40 miles. And then we give it up to the
the flamingos. They're cute.
That's right outside of Willow. Now the official start is in Willow, simply because Wasilla has gotten too busy, too many driveways, too many roads, and too many houses. We forever would cross roads and driveways. So now we start in Willow all the time. That now is the official restart, which is on Sunday, and then the race is really happening. The guy in white is one of my friends, Josh Clauder. He has one of my geriatric kennels. I have three or four geriatric teams. Selfishly, I keep some of my old timers, but they're really better off in somebody else's setting where they are treated as a whole unit. So my geriatrics go anywhere from Australia to my next door neighbor who has a few of them. Yes?
What do you consider geriatric?
Geriatric is anything over 10. You know, when you're double digits, if my breeding program is in good stead, you will probably have lost a step to where you can't keep up with those great young dogs. And then you're better off in somebody else's setting. If you run with all 10 to 14 year olds, you feel like the king, you know. And then you come running by my house doing 5 miles an hour, tails are flying, and you know, those old timers, they know exactly where they are, and they're the best. See, when I give you one of my geriatrics, they probably can teach you quite a bit about sled dogs, because for the first 10 years of their life, they had pretty reasonable education and probably run anywhere from 1 to 9 Iditarods. And those are the dogs, of course, that can teach any up-and-coming musher what a real sled dog can do. And what's really sad is when I hear, oh, he used to know the commands. If you're a dog trainer and you hear that, you know exactly what happened, you know. No, the dog still knows the command. You just don't know that the dog knows the commands, you know. So you can shell out who's good dog trainers and who's not real quick. It's not the dog forgot, it's you forgot to enforce it. Because so that's where my geriatrics go, and we have lots of old-timer stories, of course. The trail is, of course, you know, people say, what's the trail like? And I say, well, you got 2 weeks. It's about as varied as your imagination. If you can think of a trail condition, we'll probably go over it. It might not seem that way, but if you think of a steep enough hill or challenging enough of a switchback where you're going in this way, in this direction, and you're looking down to your right and you see your leader going that way, now, if you know anything about physics, something's about to happen. And 5-minute miles, that's 12 miles an hour. At 5-minute miles, you're going to really fling around that corner, you know. And you got to find just the right amount of inertia to let the sled go far enough to make that 90-degree turn downhill. If you stop too soon, you're going to wipe out. And if you don't stop soon enough, you're going to wish you had stopped a little earlier. So you're forever challenged. And of course the first 2 days are going up in the mountain range into the Alaska range, and being a former ski bum before I became a dog bum, I feel right at home in the mountains. I grew up skiing and had to play poker to pay for the ski vacation. So professional gambling is kind of in my blood. Yes, ma'am.
What about no snow?
No snow?
You ever run into that situation where there's just no snow?
Wait a couple of slides and you'll see some little bit of bare ground. Of course, on the south side of the Alaska Range, we have lots of snow. Typically the snow, as the ocean currents come from the water, it'll dump out the snow on the south side of the Alaska Range where we are now, and then we crest up and over the highest point at about 4,500 feet. This is what we call Rainy Pass, and I jokingly tell people that if you don't have your male dogs on the left, you never get by that last spruce tree. Some people really, and I had to stop making that joke because some people think I'm that poor of a dog driver that I really actually have to stop on every tree. Believe me, they learn to go on the run. That's a command that the dogs learn, just like I seen some concerned eyes right now, just like marathon runners. When you finish the Boston Marathon and you get greeted by a blanket,
You think you're cold? I don't think so. Yes.
So doesn't the urine freeze the dogs?
They're running at 106 to 108 body temperature. They're running clinically dead. They're running so hot they don't know. It shakes right out. Yeah, but you have to be careful. I mean, frostbite is definitely a potential. We have all kinds of apparatus to protect them from, mostly when it's windy. The prepuce can freeze. We have all kinds of, you know, protective devices. Yes?
What's their body temperature run at rest then?
Back to normal. We did the reason I'm saying that is we did some temperature tests on fall training, and we figured they ran hot because they come in, you know, laddered up and breathing deep. And so we had internal probes in those dogs, and I had four or five young vets, and they all brought their probes and their equipment. It was cool, you know, it was young people like you, and we ran dogs in the fall, and we ran them only like 5 or 6 miles on four-wheelers. And when they came back, they were all smiling, they're all dogs wagging their tails and standing there smiling, and they're all clinically dead. And all the vets looked at their probes. This can't be, you know, this dog is overheated. He should be collapsed, or he should be, you know, there they look and wagging their Of course, as quickly as they heat up, they come calm right down. And every time I stop, especially on fall or summer runs, we have water for them right now. They help cool off. It helps them cool off right now. So they do run quite hot. And lately we've done some thermal imaging, where another deal is where people took some thermal cameras. And as we probably know, dogs sweat on their feet somewhat, and definitely on their mouth. Our dogs, the Alaskan Husky, and I only know about the Alaskan Husky, they actually perspire a lot less on their feet. And if you think about it, of course, that makes sense, because you would lose a lot of heat through the cold snow, plus you would probably attract more snowballs. So when we first started doing that, we expected to see bright red faces and feet, but we see dark purple feet and bright red faces, so their feet. And then when you put a domesticated dog or a more domesticated dog in that team, you can tell by thermal imaging, you can tell that dog still sweats a lot more through his or her feet. Interesting finding, but yes? Absolutely. It's as hard as nutrition. The hydration program is every bit as important as nutrition. You know.
Do they eat snow?
They eat little snow to cool off mostly, which is a good indicator. If your whole team is dipping snow, you better start giving them more liquid. But hydration is every bit as important.
And what about booties? Does that help as far as nutrition?
Booties are mostly for protective devices. They don't keep any...
To keep them from cutting and...
Yeah. They're a mechanical help rather than they're not so much forewarned. So as we're going down the hill, now we've pressed at the highest part, and we start going on a little riverlet called the Dalzell Gorge.
Little river.
And it's got quite a bit of snaky turns, you know, ups and downs. And the river is steep, and it freezes to the bottom, but it flows, so it creates what we call drum ice. It backs itself up, and new layers of ice are formed on top until the water finds a new passage. So you never really know how thick the ice is, and you drive over it, it sounds like you're on a drum. And sometimes it collapses, like that little hole in front of the sideways musher. If the dogs had a foot free, you know, they would be tapping it. Come on, when's the two-legged guy finally going to get up? Susan Butcher fell in one of those holes, a big hole, big enough hole to hold her entire sled. And 20 dogs screaming and jumping on top. And, of course, those ledges are sharp and steep. She had to unload all her gear from the sled, get the sled out, and load it back on to resume travel. So it's probably the most challenging section for mushers because it's steep and challenging terrain. The biggest single danger on the race is probably the combination cold temperatures and open water. Sounds crazy, but overflow,
overflow is a phenomenon we encounter, and I lost a friend in overflow. He was stranded in 6 foot of overflow with his snow machine, ended up standing on the machine in knee-deep water, and his buddies tried to go get a boat from Golovin, which was on the coast, and he ended up dying of hypothermia. So you never know how deep the overflow is. It can be just a skiff of water on top of the ice, or it can be very, very deep and very dangerous. We get into water quite a bit, and you gotta be really careful and really with it to know what to do. As a quick introduction to overflow, water can only be compressed so much. And as ice grows on the top of the water, it expands and it pushes the water underneath itself for so long. As the ice grows, the layers of ice grow, there's only so much bottom. So eventually the water will find fissures and cracks and flows on top of itself. That's called overflow. It overflows through the fissures and cracks, often along the shore. Often there's more water on the shores of a lake than there is in the middle of the lake, ironically, in the winter. So that's called overflow, but then there's often a concealed layer because there is snow on top of the ice. So the water will seep in between the snow and the top of the ice, and the snow, of course, insulates that water. And snow is an awesome insulator, so snow can insulate 2 or 3 feet of water. And then when you get in it, you really get in it. And that's kind of a bummer. So we try to avoid water at all costs, and it can be very, very challenging to get a dog team sloshing through that stuff. And it's a big danger.
Do you ever realize that perhaps the dogs have an instinctive awareness of what's ahead of them that way?
No.
No,
my dogs are—they're smart, but they're not that smart.
Well, I didn't know maybe there was an instinctual.
Jack London. Yeah. You know that those are all Jack London stories. You know, I've been in earthquakes, I've been in volcano outbursts, I've been on floating ice, I've been scaredless, and my dogs are just wagging their tails. They just love to go wherever I want them to go. You know, so.
Did the trail breakers try and do something when they come to overflow?
Absolutely. They tried to reroute us as much as they can. The thing is, often conditions change. The trail conditions change so rapidly. We can be going down the trail, and then the trail pipeline or the bush pipeline is behind us. People are floundering in water. It's crazy, and you didn't see a speck of water. Just like the other day, I ran over a moose. I came just a couple miles from here. I came upon that moose and said, but by the time we were upon it, I was already up and over. I thought it was sleeping in the trail. I mean, it was soft and mushy and over it I went, and I looked behind me and it didn't get up. So clearly it was dead. I didn't see a speck of blood. No, nothing. I mean, it must have just gotten killed by a bunch of wolves. So, okay, chalk one off, and, got by another one. Not a big deal. But then for the rest of the race, you hear, did you see all that blood? No, I didn't see any blood, Did you see all those bones? So everybody, if we're 60 racers, and one's got to be first and one's got to be last. Every one of those individuals has now a different, because we're spread out over a maybe 10-day period of time, or not quite, maybe 5 days in this particular instance. Everybody sees that moment in their own snapshot of time, which is so cool. And as the stories go up the trail, everybody has a different take. And if you're not real experienced travelers, you don't realize that you can see from no moose to a pile of bones or nothing, and anything in between. And that's cool. That's kind of part of the...
Was that this year?
No, that was a few years ago. That's one of the dogs that actually would overeat. That's in the front. It's Jim Cooper. And the dog named King standing up is trying to eat Jim Cooper's dinner as well. King was one of the few dogs that would overeat all the time. He was an awesome eater. Alaskan Huskies are thoroughbred mongrels, designer mutts, Heinz 57, eternal children, you name it, whatever pulls hard and runs fast is beautiful.
Over the last 60 or so years, they have evolved to become unbelievable athletes. I don't think there is a four-legged individual that can do more than these dogs. They're just a humbling bunch of unbelievable travelers. Often we travel along wolf tracks or sometimes wolves, and they have put their ancestors to shame by, of course, by being fed, trained, and exercised right, and treated right. They outrun any other animal on this earth, and they do it, you know, day after day. It's just phenomenal what they can do. And of course, we put the time in. Like I said, the 100 hours that they're not running on an Iditarod is a busy time for me, where I have to make sure I give them the right amount of food, nutrition, love, attention, massage, chief cook and bottle washer all at the same time. Now that we're on the north side of the Alaska Range, we might see some bare ground. You know, the moisture will have dropped out. We might cross an occasional glacier. This is really not a glacier per se. A glacier would stay year-round. This is just a simple ice formation of a artesian well that keeps seeping out of the mountain year-round, and in the winter time, of course, it creates a pretty good-sized glacier that this picture doesn't do it justice, but it's a pretty challenging, and because of the nature of the ice formation, a very slippery formation. But that gives way to some pretty bare ground. 60 to 80 miles of this is not unusual. Mm. And that's, of course, when you... I think I made it upright this year. I have sort of one of my mini Achilles heels is there's a hump that I'm going to fall. I just know I'm going to hold on to. I'm going to fall, and I'm going to do one or two barrels of it, you know? And everything, you better be tied down and zipped up, shut, and secure, because there's that 1 mile that just goes down and around, and for some reason, I just can't keep my sled upright. And of course, my dogs know that, so they... Yeah. Okay, they get the 5 minutes where they're in charge, you know, they get to fuck off the guy. But I made it this year, so I was pretty happy that's not at all unusual, since we're on the north side of the Alaska Range, so where the wind blows, where it's relatively dry. Sled dogs are only this incredibly good because we don't have a lot of snow in Alaska. Alaska is more of an arid desert than anything else. There really is not that much snow. Otherwise, the dogs couldn't do what they're doing. They couldn't run 150 or 280 miles a day. If we ever need snowshoes, we know we're done. I mean, there was races where Timmy Osmore would be on foot, and then I would come back behind him on snowshoes, and then somebody else on snowshoes, and then the fourth person would drive the four dog teams. Mm. And you're talking, you're making, you know, a mile an hour progress. Mm-hmm. You're breaking trail that way. So then when Timmy was worn out, he would get on the sled, and then I would take off my snowshoes, because you can't snowshoe in, you know, 4 foot of snow, where you actually literally thrown yourself into the fresh snow. And then the snowshoer, Aditi, would snowshoe, and Susan Butcher would be yelling behind us. And we just take turns, you know. Rick Swenson was 2 miles back, just taking a coffee break. So, glare ice, you know, if I have glare ice at home, great, I go out and train on it. Usually about the second week, third week of October, we do glare ice training. The people that don't, they wish they had by the time they get onto the Farewell Lakes. You know, in dog training, there's opportunities that are hard to find, and stuff like that is kind of hard to find if you're a mere mortal. So when you have situations where it's blowing, or where it's glare ice, or where it's real slippery, if you want to be successful on the trail, you probably should go out and practice on it. So when people call me and say, hey, it's too cold to run, or it's too windy to run, I say, okay, I'm going. It's just a different mindset. You know, what sets the winner apart is being able to deal with just about any situation. And the Farewell Lakes, of course, and the so-called burn, where we literally to this day pick our way through about 380,000 acres of burned trees, those are challenges that the dogs just need to trust in. Just imagine I'm free running my dogs all summer long, and we jump in those lakes to cool them off, and then by the middle of October I'm going to ask them to go over that lake on foot. That takes some trust.
and sometimes takes me going out there and dancing on the lake and telling them you can make it. And, you know, it's a continued evolution of working with your dogs and trusting them.
When did the burn happen?
Burn happened in 1974, 1975.
Mm. They're starting to come back right now. It's like time-lapse photography. If you only go through there once a year, you know, you see this tree and you pay attention where you're going, you know. So now it's kind of it's kind of cool. It's really neat to me. If you only do it once or twice, it's no big deal. But having done my 26 times, it's really cool. Right now, there's a lot of revegetation happening. It's really not burning now. You know, you can still see lots of burnt trees, but it's been a long time. See, I'm going awfully slow, just like I did this year on the other. Once you pass the burn, you get a totally different trail experience. Now, all the first challenging 250 miles are over, and now you're leapfrogging your same competitors. And the trail has been more forgiving. We're looking back at the Alaska Range. You see the mountains we just have come over. But now their challenges change a little bit. Now we're doing some river traveling, some mining roads will greet us until we get into what I call the deep interior, where there is very, very little traffic. We have pretty easy trail. But of course, you're starting to be fatigued and you're starting to, you know, feel it because you haven't slept very much. The first couple of days you don't sleep anyway because you're too amped up, and then at first you wish you could sleep and then you can't stay awake. It's kind of one of those weird things. The race, of course, goes on day and night. Most of the pictures are, for obvious reasons, taken in the daylight. But the dogs go day and night. They of course, they find a good rhythm and they go day and night.
Is there a part of the trail that you refuse to do at night?
No.
No.
I've done every section of trail by darkness or daylight. I can't afford to wait for either or. Some rookies might be advised to do the switchbacks in the daylight.
Like the steps or the gorge.
The steps,
like,
yeah. The steps, you end up usually doing one or the other.
Yeah.
The way the race works, you can do one or the other. So I tell the rookies, don't worry about that trail intelligence. You know, if they say, oh, the steps are really bad, don't worry about it. You're going to have to deal with them anyway. You're going to have to deal with every obstacle as it arises. Plus, by the time you come around, it might be totally forgiving. It might have grooved out, or it might have softened up, or it might have gotten harder. Don't worry about for hours or days in advance, let you get all in a knot, and then don't even remember where it was because it was so easy. And if it's difficult, you have to overcome it. The more important is the rapport with the dogs. I tell the rookies, when you get to the switchbacks or the steps or the gorge or the water, if your dogs listen to you, you're glad you listened to my talk. The dogs don't listen to you, you will remember the talk. Teach your dogs to listen to you. You know, if you tell them to go slow, going slow is every bit as important as going fast. Sometimes you win races by going slow, not necessarily going fast. So it's teamwork. This is a picture taken at the coldest that I have raced through, 63 below actual temperature. What happens with a dog at 60 below is really phenomenal. And when I started wearing my clothing system that's called Northern Outfitters, which is a monolithic system, one layer per person, very much like the dogs, then I became a better dog driver because I finally could understand how an individual can be warm at 60 below. That's why I told one of the young people here that take the cold out of the equation. Just think that you're comfortable. And then run the Iditarod. If you have the right gear, you'll be comfortable most of the time. And that's why the dogs, but the dogs do it for totally different reasons, of course. They stay comfortable because they don't perspire on their body. You're only uncomfortable or cold because you've got moisture evaporating from wherever it condenses. Now, if you have a monolithic, if you have one layer system and that condensation happens on the outside, you stay dry, and because you stay dry, you stay warm. And the inch of layer of dry foam around you, or insulation,
keeps the body temperature from your 100 and so body temperature to ambient temperature. And the condensation happens on the outside. So the gradient is gradual from body to ambient temperature. And the condensation is on the outside and you stay warm, whether it's 30 above or 60 below. And that's really, really hard to comprehend. My gear that works for me from start to finish gets better the colder it is. And that takes some getting used to. Now when you think about it, of course that's what these dogs have. Now we put blankets over them and coats and all that, but they only have one coat per customer. And it better keep them warm. And they're phenomenal how they can stay warm. Plus, of course, the good thing about 60 below, it's warmer somewhere else. It's too cold to really rest. It's too cold to really do much. So you just run 5 minutes, and you wear everything, including your sleeping bag. And then after 5 minutes of running, you're so darn hot, you've got to ride the runners again. And, you know, then within 5 minutes, you're freezing cold again. So you just keep on going, and it's going to be warmer somewhere else. And that be your salvation. Mm. Of course, this person doesn't know how to race at all. they don't want to age. I mean, I don't want to age, so I do what I call the Norton Sound facelift, and that's you expose your face to the cold and you flash freeze your skin, and at the finish line you peel off that top layer and you throw it away. You know, I'm 85 years old. And I think I'm doing okay, right? Of course, it gets dangerous when it gets really, really cold. And you do have to protect. I peeled my fingers pretty good this year, but maybe running two cold 1,000-mile races contributed. This middle finger is not from frostbite, and this is not from frostbite either. I lived in Iran when I was a little boy and got bit by a fly, and then when I was reasonably grown up, I got my hand in a table saw. So I got scars that look like frostbite that have nothing to do with the cold. A great aspect of the race, of course, is the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. You know, just imagine sitting down and drinking a cup of coffee while racing. Watching the northern lights, a light display that is almost personal disco show for you while the race is going on. Giving interviews to some, you know, to Donna Navarona, who has won Olympic medals, sitting in Shaktulik while every second counts. You gotta rest the dogs, mind you. You gotta divide your time so that the dogs do the absolute best, and hopefully the tank is not empty before you get to the finish line. But everything you do counts, and there's so many aspects, from trail to spectators to pilots to officials to checkers to your competitors to the media to the great part of the beauty of the land. And that, of course, is a huge part of my love is the beauty of Alaska. Is we're training or running on some indigenous trails that have been there for a long, long time, and we have the honor to travel over them. So that's pretty neat. And again, Alaska sometimes is warm. You know, we all took a bath here in the very center, just before the dogs are going to jump in the water here. There's a little patch of white. The bridge is actually to the left of the dogs, and the dogs are going to avoid that bridge because it's brown. It looks like the water. It's a bunch of logs with a bunch of spruce boughs over it. To their right, they see the patch of snow, and they think that's the trail. So they're going to run right to that white patch, and then the leaders are going to fall into the water, and the swing dogs are going to jump right after them. And we all did that. We all did the same exact thing. About half the team was in the water swimming, and then they got on the bridge and they said, oh, you know, and scrambled on the bridge. And fortunately, by the time the sled got near, we were already back onto the main trail. And the camera, of course, whenever you see a camera, you've got to be really suspicious. You know, something's about to happen. Those guys, of course, have turned around. They were there, some of the medias, or they might have even landed with a helicopter. You know, the more cameras you see, the more like, oh, something's about to happen. And it screws up the dog sometimes. You know, they might look up And they might lose concentration because they see a gaggle of photographers, and they lose concentration, and then, you know, something bad happens. So, just, yes?
If the dogs go in the water and they really get wet, are you better off to just keep running and let them work that?
Yeah.
That wetness.
Absolutely. They got the spin and dry cycle. We let them run. We let them roll around in the snow. Sometimes it depends. It depends, you know. There's no, what I've learned over the years is, of course, there's no patent answer for every situation. But mostly they just roll in the snow for a little bit, shake it off, and keep on going. I guarantee you, at 50 below, when you jump in the water, nothing comes out. I've seen dogs, I've gotten into 45 below water, which sounds crazy. How can it be 45 below and there's lots of water around? The Copper Basin is usually a wet race, and we had to used to have to go through a lot of water. One year I came into a checkpoint, and that's a road race, meaning that your truck can go to the checkpoints. And I got into the checkpoint and I just threw my dogs in the truck. And I said, you know, if you want to disqualify me, go right ahead. But my dogs were literally icing up. And I said to the officials, you better let everybody put their dogs in their truck because damage is going to be done. It was 45 below, and no matter how much they were shaking, they tried to shake their hair, the moisture up, it was just, I mean, they were like icicles. So I let them rest 6 or 8 hours, I don't remember, it's a long time, let them rest in my truck, and when they came out, they were all cozy and fine, and we kept on going. You know, everybody except the president, and everybody was allowed to do that. On Iditarod, of course, we can't do that. Sometimes you make a big fire, and you do all this kind of stuff. You wring out your equipment and put the dogs in a huddle, and the best, of course, is not to go into those situations. Yeah. Calvin and Blondie, Riptide, Sister, Ingot, Poydras, all kinds of good dogs. The booties are worn mostly for protection. Nowadays, we booty the entire team, because it's more efficient to protect every foot than to only deal with feet that might crack or might already have a problem. Key to that, of course, is to have your dogs have their feet messed with from birth. Day one, I stick puppies in my... It looks like I have three in there right now. I stick puppies in my shirt and I walk around the kennel with them. I carry them around wherever I go, and when I pull them out, instinctively I rub their feet. Because sooner or later, the vets will check their feet on a regular basis. I will check their feet on a constant basis. And my dogs are just as ticklish as your dogs are on their feet. My dogs let you spread their toes apart, let you look at the connective tissue, let you roll over their feet. And most of yours probably don't, because you didn't make a big deal about it from birth. You know, I hold my puppies by their feet and rub them all the time because of this, because they're going to wear booties. Same with the dew claws. The dew claws come off about, you know, 24 to 36 hours after they're born, mostly because there's going to be a secondary problem. If you have dew claws, the rubs from the booties is worse than some of the foot problems initially. So if you have dogs with dew claws, I have all kinds of little tricks how to not make it a big issue. Yes?
How many dogs on a typical race will you drop?
However, as many as I need. I drop you at the blink of an eye. I'm the worst. We're allowed 16 dogs at the start. We have to start with a minimum of 12. We have to finish with a minimum of 6. If a dog just hacks, coughs, doesn't finish his or her meal, I drop him. If you look at statistics on the Iditarod, I will have the fewest dogs earliest of anybody, and I often have the most dogs at the finish. My drop rate is usually, you know, I pride myself of not only seeing what's happening. It's real easy if you're real experienced, it's real easy to see what's going on. What's real difficult is to see what's about to go on. The anticipation, the insight, if your dog is, you know, Celine has one ear up and one ear down. If 2 ears or 1.5 ears down, something's not right. I know that dog's not going to make it to the finish line. I probably keep her for one more checkpoint. She might have had a bad day. If she doesn't totally recover, if she doesn't look 100%, I send her home. If you drop a dog, you're never wrong, because you did the right thing by the dog.
Can you
Can you drop a dog temporarily?
No, you can't. You can never get them back in the team. So
even
once,
if you carry them for
well, I carry them all the time. I give them rides. We call it, we don't drop them then.
Okay.
We just
that's
give them
not
rides.
An official drop.
That's right. Yeah. Once they're signed out, they get flown off the trail. And that's the first time they're allowed to receive medicine. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why we would leave dogs behind. They might need an anti-inflammatory or some medication. We're not allowed to give them any oral medication while they're on the race, of course. They have to perform totally on their own merit. And we're not allowed to use any drugs on them. So sometimes, I have the dogs receive Rimadyl as soon as I drop them, give them over to a vet, and then I joke, can I have them back now? It doesn't work that way, of course. And I keep stressing that to all the people I coach. You're never wrong if you drop a dog.
I remember reading about this year, but I can't remember. Drug testing for the dogs?
Drug
during
testing?
Or just before and after?
No, drug testing is ongoing. Drug testing, the P team, as we lovingly call them, they're ongoing, and you never know when you're encountering them. They typically take a little Ziploc bag with a little bungee elastic and two alligator clips, zip it on the dog, and we bring them over to a neighboring sled, and you get a sample real quick. If they don't get urine, they could draw blood. And it's a random generated list of we're going to get you in Unalakleet, and we never know where. We know the top 20 teams will be tested at the finish, and in between, we never know. This year, I didn't see any. I think I got tested at the end, but I didn't. My schedule happened to be, or my number was not up anywhere until the.
Well, that would obviously keep people from slipping Rimadyl when they're out of a checkpoint.
Absolutely. Well, no, that's the idea of drug testing. Of course, we're going to drug test mushers too here before too long, which is not too bad. You know, we make a living with our animals, so we need to make sure our animals are totally clean. And we might need to make sure that some mushers are totally clean, just like Olympic athletes. It's the same. It's the same program, and not so much in the canines. It's not so much for performance enhancing drugs as what we call masking agents. Rimadyl is a good example. Painkillers, anti-inflammatories would be a much wider used or more abuse. Then there's really nothing that can, short of maybe blood doping or some real complicated, situation that would actually make these dogs run beyond their natural abilities. I can't think of any medicine that would make them go faster.
What about there's a supplement, they call it, is it MSM? You guys can look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that allowed?
The joints?
Yeah, the joints. Is that allowed? Because I started using it with my doc dog.
Yeah, I don't know what MSM
is.
It's
a natural
chondroitin
sulfate.
Chondroitin sulfate. There's medicine that's borderline. Cosequin is one of those. You know, Adequan, Cosequin is the synovial fluid in your joints.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the naturally occurring substance. And if you can get it into them in an oral pill form, is that doping or not? That's one of those gray areas. You know. Plus, you can't test for it. Now, I don't. I think my dogs have enough synovials. You know, the deal with all those supplements. Every supplement makes the dogs 5% faster, or 2% faster, or adds a mile an hour. Now, if I take all that crap and put it in a bowl, I'm going 100 miles an hour.
You can't keep up.
The way I always test that is. Some guy will come up to me and say, if you give that to your dog, I guarantee they'll go a mile an hour faster. And say, and how fast am I going right now? Doesn't matter. You know, just like that person that's going to guarantee my sons he's going to improve a letter grade in school. Well, he's an A student. You know, so what's a letter grade improvement over an A student? You're still an A student, I think. Same with my dogs. If they run 5-minute miles, they almost ran 5-minute miles all the way to Nome in 02. They can't go much faster. And if you come up with something that makes them go even faster, it's probably illegal. You know, so
Good thing we have a Democrat in the White House again. I can start making my Bill jokes again. Hillary, the white bitch, is behind the swing dogs. I have to be really careful when we had all those Republicans. And I had a presidential litter, and Al Gore didn't make it. And Ross Perot was out before he was even, before we started the race. So now at least I can start making some Democrats. But that's some of my old-timey dogs. There's a distinctive-looking dog, Milk Cow. And he's to this day represented in a lot of my black and white dogs that we see. The dog in the middle is a big male dog named Milk Cow, next to the red dog. And of course, the rest of the guys are in there. Bill and Blondie. Blondie is one of those perpetually happy dogs. Pardon?
Blondie's a winning dog.
Yeah, these happen to be winning dogs here, fortunately. So we like to look at that picture in my family.
Aww.
Dave is a full brother to D2. He's a winning dog. He won a few Iditarods. He has two protective issues on. He has the red part is a coat, a dog coat that we put on in cold temperature. And then the poly blankets is something we only use in checkpoints that we throw over to break the microclimate to keep the dogs even warmer. We put that over them. Here you see the protective coats that the dogs wear. Not so much for the temperature, but for the wind. Wind carries your body heat away, and even as thin little layer of protection will keep the body heat in, and that's what we do.
Does it also protect them from, like, the sun?
The sun is usually not a problem.
Warm?
We don't get... Rarely do we have to deal with the heat. The middle of March, we have 12 hours of daylight, 12 hours of darkness. If it ever gets into the 50s, we're running a warm race. And sometimes we have to schedule our runs so it doesn't get too hot. So we would rest longer in the heat of the day, let the dogs soak up the sun, and then run a little more in the nighttime. I just put this in because sometimes I do get off the sled and actually work a little bit. But at 5 or 6 minute miles, you're not going to do a lot of running in Arctic gear.
Mm-hmm.
The only time you can run is uphill. The rest of the time we pedal. We pedal, and I introduced years and years ago, I introduced ski poles because, like I said, it was a ski bum before it was a dog bum.
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays everybody carries ski poles, and we kind of have four spare dogs, you know, one, two, three, four, and we use them quite substantially. This is a good example of where the dogs were momentarily distracted. That's that same team, that's Milk Cow again. He just got done taking a bath. Where we are is where a whole conglomerate of photographers was looking at the dogs. And my leaders looked up, and of course they're coming barreling around that corner there. They looked up, looked at the media, and then they looked down and said, oh, no way. You know, by the time they had distracted those few steps, the situation looked totally different. The first 15 teams were all bunched up. And then, of course, the media had enough good pictures, so they left. And I made a point of asking my fellow competitors whether they had the same problems we had on the water crossing there between Caltech and Unalakleet. And when the media was gone, all the dogs went, they tried to hop across the water, but then of course they can't clear quite that big of a jump. So most of them got in a little bit, like that black and white dog there behind Milk Cow. That's two dogs actually. They tried to leap out, and all the subsequent teams tried to make it like that and never missed a step. So.
Mm.
But like I said, they have the spin and dry cycle. Yes.
Wouldn't your sled just go ahead and sink after the dogs have?
Yeah.
Matter if the dogs go in the water or not?
Well, you try to stay dry. See what you do, and now you're going in that water, and now you're going to start to use your upper body because you're hopefully you're going to get your feet dry, stay dry. Then you don't have to change. If your stuff gets wet, those sled bags are pretty waterproof. They can be in the water a little bit. We swam for 30 miles last year, in the Cusco.
we had a situation where the boy, my boy Roan, actually, we call it the Cusco Swim, the last 30 miles of a race, water had come up. We were running into tidal influences of the lower Cusco Swim, backed up with a lot of wind. We had 30 miles of trail where at times all the dogs were swimming. All the dogs were doggy paddling. That was very, very dangerous. And it would have never happened if it wasn't the last 30 miles of the race. We just had to get there. There was nothing else to do, but it was, that was very, potentially very, very dangerous.
Was
we
it
were
dark
belly,
as well?
Huh?
Was it dark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we were belly button deep. Talk about shrinkage factor. We were literally, I mean, I was literally steering the dogs at times when they were paddling.
Hmm.
And I learned, in that situation, I turned the light off. Because a lot of people have problems, because if your headlight is on, the dogs, it was brown. It's brown. When you're in that much water, it all looks, because of the tannin and of the dirt and stuff in the water, it's all, it looks like a brown ocean. Yet your light illuminates so much, and then of course it gives out. So the dogs forever thought the edges were white, because that's where the light ended.
Mm.
So it was white there, and it was brown in the middle. So the dogs, everybody else's dogs, kept veering from the left to the right, thinking that's where the trail is, of course, looking. And Roan, I had broken my shoulder blade. That's a different story. So I had the B team that race. He had a 3.5 hour lead, 50 miles from the finish. And in that last 30 miles, I made up 3.5 hours, of course, by experience. In fact, of course, I didn't know that. I didn't know he had some pretty big problems, and everybody else did too. But when I finally got to the finish line, I saw him at the finish line. I thought, this is really cool. Because we're in a bush race. We're way off the road system, so you have a host family and no dog trucks or nothing. I said, oh, he had brought the dogs to his host family, and he's coming to see old man finish, you know. He had finished just a couple of minutes ahead.
Mm.
So, that's a lot of... Sailing down the trail, that, of course, has gotten disallowed. I introduced the wind sail to the racing situation, and when people realized I had a lot more hot air than the rest of them, they I actually pushed the issue. I got together with a sailmaker and ended up making some pretty skookum sails, but they were going to be front mounted on my sled and would harness a lot more than just a tailwind. So I presented it to the rules committee, thinking, of course, everybody has the same amount of wind. If you want to carry a sail, you should be able to sail. You know, I mean, it's the wind is there for everybody. Plus, later, of course, we found the explorers, mm-hmm. and the early mushers, they used wind sails all the time. But they disallowed it, so I just, no more sailing. But this is
the mushers have the seats that they sit on.
That was an example. I said, so you don't let me sail. Do you not let me sit down, because that makes my sled a couch? You know, no, we can sit down. So we're using some of those indigenous trail. I should go back to this one. Look how it's worn into the tundra by centuries of travel. And we get a privilege of traveling over the old trails. A good tripod is a semi-permanent or permanent piece of marking that's three sticks put together. Two the same length and the long one, the third one should point in the direction of travel. That's a good trail marker. And we navigate sometimes by stars or moons, because later on it has two or three moons when you're on the coast. You know,
okay.
There's two north stars up there. And, you know, you're getting so wrong. I could write a book on hallucinations alone.
Yeah.
When we used to be on the trail for 17 days, man, oh man, we'd have free hallucinations from about halfway on. Now that we're doing it in half the time, we hardly hallucinate anymore. So maybe that's why I ran 2,000-mile races back to back. But that again, you know, the sun rises, the sun downs, the moon rises, the moon downs. It's just, it's unbelievable, the intensity of the climate. I love this because it shows the interest of the kids. When Iditarod comes through, of course, school is out, everybody's at the checkpoint. And just to show you a little bit, you know about baseball and maybe football and basketball. When these kids come to the checkpoint, watching the vets interact with my dogs and me, they will look at the dogs and say, where's Milk Cow?
Hmm.
Or, you know, is Eleanor still in lead? Or D2 was in the many commercials, fortunately, with me, and one, the most famous one, he drove off my dog truck and I was running behind. And to this day, sometimes kids come and say, does D2 really know how to drive? The dog is long gone, and of course the commercial is not shown anymore, but certain dogs become very famous. And that just shows you how in tune the kids are with their indigenous sport. And that to me is a great honor. And the fact that there's no MD on the trail, of course, is just a sidebar. When I modified my hand 4 days before the race, I got these three fingers in a dado blade on a table saw and then decided to run. Of course, I was supposed to race one-handed, and from about the third or fourth checkpoint on, the vets would... And the first time was really funny. We didn't eat dinner just now, so... I said, Doc, I need you. I need to maybe put some sutures in. And he says, what dog? You know, I was, oh shit, well, you know. I don't think we can have a dog with sutures running the race. And I said, no, it's the two-legged dog. So he brought his surgical kit in. You know, it's a green packet. You know, you guys know. And, you know, it's all, everything is in there, tools and sutures. And vets are usually pretty hardy fellows. So I had my hand severely bandaged, and we were sitting across from each other in a one-room cabin on a table in Roan River, and he unfurled his tools and I unfurled my bandage, and I said, hey, look, it's growing back. It's green and it's almost back to normal size. Kind of throbbing a little bit doing that pulsating thing, and it of course needed to be put together in some places. And he about passed out. I'm sure he's seen cows and horses, you know, slain open, but he never quite worked on the amputated fresh fingers. Of course, subsequently, in every checkpoint, the vets have to see the finger and work on it. So I joke, I gave a lot of vets the finger. Which is really not what I normally do. So, but it helped, and I finished lucky 13th that year. So I, at least I got to it. I knew it was going to be a painful event, and I figured that was the first race I ever started, thinking I might not get to the finish line. I knew it was going to be miserable, and I might as well be miserable on the trail rather than be miserable at home. So sometimes it gets pretty flat. This is where Libby Riddles won her Iditarod in 19, I believe this was 85, when the boys were playing basketball in Chactulik. And it was so nasty that only the best of the leaders could make it through a storm. And she tied herself to the sled and trusted her lead dog by the name of Sister, who belonged to an Eskimo friend of mine, Joe Garney. She literally just tied herself to the sled and told Sister to go. And she got to, at the time, there's a shelter cabin off the site, but at the time there was no shelter cabin yet. She got to this outcropping of rocks and stayed there and was miserable for 4 hours. And then kept on going. It's basically 56 miles across the frozen ocean. Not much for landmarks, and only the best of the trained dogs get there. And that set her apart. That gave her a 4-hour lead that was whittled away throughout the last 200 miles. But she became the first woman to win the other run. And of course, you're starting to wonder how long. And I know you guys are wondering too. How long is it going on yet? There is ongoing challenges when the wind blows on those flat ocean passages like we are here. We're actually on frozen ocean. The eyes of the dog sometimes get caked with ice, and we stop and we clean them out. In that 91 storm, I saw a new thing for the first time and never seen it since. It actually froze the dog's little masks on their faces, and I'd leave them on for a while, and every 20 minutes to 30, 20 to 30 minutes, we'd take them off. But what was really cool is when I took those cups, I called them cups off their noses, and they were just like little clown masks, really. You know, you get those different dog noses that have a little stupid little rubber band, and they just looked like that. They had little masks on their faces, and I learned to take them off, and they liked that. But when you look into them, inside that cup, there was two snake fang-like protrusions, two icicles that were shaped exactly the shape of their nostrils.
Hmm.
That ice was protruding way into their into their noses, and the body heat would melt them in perfect snake-like fang, curved just like the dog's noses were, and if you took them off just right, I would look, and it's so vivid in my mind. That's such a surreal, crazy thing. Of course, you don't save them. You can't, you know, they just, you know. But it was just unreal what those dogs can do. Then they, you know, okay, you know, what do we do next? Unbelievable. Water, when you see water, now you're really, you got a pucker factor of probably 20 on a scale of 10. Now we're really, if you see open water on the coast, it gets really dangerous. And the most scared I've been is probably in a situation like that. That brown or the dark stuff is water in the background. And I followed an old trail once, and everything was kind of going. Everything was going up and down, and I thought that's really crazy. That can't be what I'm thinking it is. This ocean can't be moving. And I pushed off real hard between my runners, and 2 inches of ice gave way to green, gray, bubbly water. And talk about a cardiac test. That's a good test for your ticker. I beelined it right over to the land. And this year, for instance, we couldn't use this section. There is, of course, an overland trail that has had to be used. The mail has to go through. A lot of this, if not 95% of the trail that we're using, was original mail routes, Pony Express type. You know, the mail had to go through. The goods had to come in. So the old timers, they made overland trails, but of course would use the path of least resistance most of the time. Yes.
So is global warming affecting the race much, or how do you feel about
it?
It
was 50 below this year for a long time. You know, we've seen fluctuations, of course, over the years, but there is definitely, we never used to get rained on.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays we've seen rain. I talked to a lot of, last year I worked for the World Wildlife Fund as a global, what they call me, climate witness. We've seen stuff in the last few years that we never seen before. And they're looking for people that have done a certain thing for a long time. My friend Joe Garney's my age, so he's 50-something. He's never seen it rain in February until just recently. You know, his father probably didn't either, but maybe his great-great-grandfather used to see lots of rain in February. Who knows? We don't know. We're just a snapshot in time, but we certainly do see things that people have not seen in years past. But I can't say what cycle we're in. But we certainly hate rain. I mean, when I'm out there, I much rather have snow than rain. Rain is just bad. And the dogs, of course, they don't like the rain either, because they're really not made for rain. They're made for the dry snow that peels off their clothes so easy. That's D2 and Tyrone, his half-brother. Dave is in the left swing, and Dagger is on the right swing. That's a father and his three sons in the first two positions of that team. The whole team is comprised of, there's Jose, Handyman, Brower, IBM. Eleanor is in wheel in this particular picture. That shows you that the leader can migrate throughout the team. Of course, we sometimes have 12 to 14 leaders in the team, and they take different times in lead. The more we can job share, the better off the dogs are. I always have some good leaders way back, so they can take a turn or a rest in the respect.
Does their turn as leaders depend on the terrain?
Terrain.
Some dogs that are better.
Pearl, for instance, she loves racing uphill. Stupid. I mean, I never taught her that. You know, at one point she decided racing uphill is cool. She's a so-so dog. She's not a standout. But when we go uphill, she's crazy. So the first, you know, the second day from Frusquentin to Rainy Pass, she'll be in lead, dragging that team up the mountain. Something clicked at one point, as dog trainers know, you know, the golden moment, the jackpot moment, is we look for them all the time, but a lot of them happen without our knowledge. A lot of those dogs will make connections that, you know, trigger their idiosyncrasies, and we have absolutely no, we can pretend we know, but we have no idea when and how that happened. You know, I don't know when she decided racing uphill was cool.
No, but the key is to recognize.
Yeah, well, so you make the best for the team's benefit. Kira doesn't like to get her feet wet. If I'm on the coast, I put Kira in lead, I know she'll go to Des Moines before she goes to Nome. I mean, there's water, she'll take the biggest detour. Well, she's never going to get me in trouble. Yet, when we're on the Kuskokwim, I got to go sometimes for miles through water. Kira will find herself way back in the team because she will have not a choice but to run through the water. So it's just, you know, we make all those idiosyncrasies hopefully work out to the betterment of the team. And if we do the right thing, then we outrun Susan. Look, you hear that? I just leave her in there because in my formative years, like I said, she certainly was a driving force. Of course, she died of leukemia a few years ago. And I feel like I should leave a picture of her in my slideshow to honor her, because she certainly, in part, changed the race, if nothing else, for publicity reasons. She of course, brought the race. I think women have, for many reasons, have an advantage over us guys. But she certainly put the race on the map, you know. And when it comes to toughness and body weight, and maybe every bit as important, or maybe more important, the nurturing instinct that the female tends to have more naturally, which of course benefits the dogs tremendously, I think us guys were disadvantaged. So to honor Susan, I will leave a slideshow in the presentation all the time. At the same time, of course, I think I have another guy. This guy here, he's another friend of mine. This is actually one of the few pictures. That's when it's getting bad. I'm good. This is one of the 91 pictures when the storm was almost over. If you can't see your outstretched hand in front of your arm, it's kind of nasty. And very much like this carpet, everything in this world has a directional orientation. And our orientation was literally between our feet. We'd see the scratch marks of the wind, the direction of the blow, and the travel of the snow machines and prior dog teams and travelers. We would look for scratch marks, and that was our direction. That's how we navigated during this storm.
The dogs know to follow those kind of...
Dogs followed me. That it's so complex when you're... This is, like I said, this is good. The dogs can see here, but it was so bad that I had to be the lead dog. And that's when Eleanor and I, I had a leash attached. And one of the reasons I learned so much during that particular trip was because you feel every tug. The sled, of course, kept falling over. The sled would get blown on its side. And eventually, you just leave it on its side because it strings out the team just nice. And it's going to blow over anyway. So why should you set it back up? So that strung out the team and I pretty good. But you'd feel every time a dog goes to the bathroom or steps over a log or gets tangled up or, you know, is looking back or is shaking or rubbing his eyes on the gang line, you feel that. When you're the leader, you feel that. And it made me much more sympathetic, made me a much better driver, because, of course, the less tug you have in the gang line, the smoother it is for everybody. So that storm was it was literally a life-changing situation for many people. The storm raged up and down the coast. So there was like 70-some people in this race, and everybody was affected. Some people gave up the sport. Some people found religion. Some people found themselves. Two examples, one of my white guy friends, he lost his dogs during that storm, and he walked around all night looking for them. And almost died. One of my Eskimo friends lost his dogs. I said, oh shit, I lost my dogs, and sat down You know, did the Eskimo pull in your hands in your park and crossed his legs and sat for almost 24 hours? Didn't waste an energy, didn't waste an ounce of energy, sat there on the trail until it subsided and then found his dogs a few hundred yards from him. He had enough, that's Joe Garney, that's what my friends would tell us. He had enough wherewithal to know that it doesn't matter. If it's blowing like that, you're not going to find your dogs. I mean, why waste energy? Why possibly kill yourself? It's only a storm. But he's born in the wind. He was raised in that sort of environment. So there he sat. I mean, nobody traveled anyway. Everybody was stuck somewhere. You know, he wasn't going to get run over by a snowmobile or anything. Yeah, the dogs are, other than there's that one 24 hour when we take a day off, a break, I take their harnesses off. But the rest of the time, the dogs are in harness all the time. So I shall, until I beat Swenson, he has 5 championships to his name, and I only have 4. So until I beat him, I'll leave a picture, a little self-motivation of him in the slideshow as well. So. But we're getting close to your relief. We're getting close to the finish line here. And Safety Roadhouse, of course, is the last checkpoint. You have 20 more miles to go. On a good year, the snow machiners can actually drive out to Safety and do so in masses and come see the teams go through the last checkpoint. And then, of course, you start getting to the to Nome, which is kind of a culture shock. And, took me 9 years to win my first Iditarod, 4:17 a.m. But who's paying attention? I studied horticulture, so one of my, when you try to be successful, you visualize stuff. And one of my visualization exercises was to see the dogs get draped with the yellow roses at the finish line, because just like the Kentucky Derby, the winning leaders get draped with the yellow roses, and I envisioned that day. That was going to be so cool. Well, it finally happened, and the darn things were made out of silk. I was so disappointed, I almost turned around and went back the other way. By then, of course, you're so glad that the race is over. So if you think about it, of course, the flowers are made out of silk. Otherwise, they wouldn't last any length of time. So I was fortunate to receive that a few times. But I use that as an example of not only visualize winning or success, but what really actually matters more from a human point of view is what you do with that success. Where do you go from there? And I use that in a lot of my team building talks and my motivational speeches. Is let yourself visualize success. Let yourself get to where you make all the money you want, or have the car you want, or be as successful as you possibly want to see yourself. But really more important is what you're going to do with that success, because that's going to be what judges you. Doesn't matter how many games you won, how many diplomas you have, how many times you have done it. Ultimately, what matters the most is how you have achieved what you achieved. And that's where the true pride comes in. That's where, when your peers judge you, hopefully they will say he did it right. There's a few people in this race that would drive over their mother in order to win and never look back. They have very little respect. And then there's some people that have given their jackets off their backs and have never won the race and are as much of a champion as some people that have won the other race. So, but that's that. We don't need to do that sort of speech here, but it's heartfelt, and of course I've been fortunate to have great dogs such as Blondie and Fearless that have led me to a couple of victories. In 94, it's probably the most incredible race for me, simply because that yielded two records. I can just tell the story in an hour, or I can tell it in a few minutes. To me, it's very much like the 91 story. The 02 story is very much important to my family. 9/11, it was Tuesday morning when the second plane hit the tower at 7 a.m. in Alaska. I was on my way to a Rotary meeting. I turned around, kept my wife, my kids home, and I said, this is a big deal. I had been Alaskan for over 25 years, and I was honoring the state, and I had great honors such as representing the state of Alaska with my dogs at the inaugural parade for presidential elections. I was Alaskan through and through, but this was a bigger deal. That very afternoon, I sent off my naturalization papers, and of course, long story short, and I can really draw it out, but long story short is we started our private swearing-in ceremony downtown Anchorage at the day of the Iditarod start. And I carried my first American flag and the paperwork to be signed by the judge in Nome at the finish line. That year I set the record that still stands to this day and go in the books for having the fastest Iditarod in 8 days, 22 hours, 46 minutes, and 2 seconds, but who's counting? And also have the swearing-in ceremony that lasted well over 10 days. So those two records are probably, hopefully stand for a while. Luna on our far left, Kira and Bronson are the three lead dogs that, because I couldn't decide who had the great honor to pull me across the finish line, or I had the great honor to be behind of, I put those three leaders in the team to come across the finish line first. They quickly made a rule that you can only have two leaders in the winning in the, across the finish line. So Bronson and Kira ended up being the champions of 02, and they got the yellow roses that particular year. And my wife gave me permission to go again next year. So with any luck, I'll do a little better than I did this year. Thank you very much for your attention. And that was only 2 hours. See, I can go on for days.
Oh, yeah.
There's usually lots of questions, and feel free to ask lots of questions. I shall be here.
I think if you don't mind, we'll give everybody a comfort break.